Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, and welcome to Inside Scoop Live. Thanks for tuning in. I'm your host, Juanita Watson, and today I have invited back to the program a longtime friend of ours, author Alan McLeod. Alan has just released his fourth book, which is the third in his Paige Harrington mystery series, and it's titled The Money Washers. So a little bit about Alan. Alan McLeod was born and raised in a collection of small rural villages in southern and central Alberta. At the mostly four-room schools he attended, he was fortunate to encounter a string of dedicated teachers who fostered a love for reading and writing the English language, skills which he took with him through his career in finance and then into writing full-time. At the age of 17, he left home and went to work as a junior clerk in a local bank. Good luck and timing followed, and he ended up having a rewarding and challenging career that took him to Calgary, Alberta, Montreal, Quebec, and then to New York. He has lived in New York City since 1970. And subsequent to leaving the banking business in 1982, he worked at a number of ventures and then has been writing full-time since 2000. So I am just so happy to have Alan back here today to talk with us. So welcome back, Alan.
Thanks, Juanita. Wow, when you read all that, it seems like I've done far more than I ever thought I had.
Oh, come on. You've had a very full, rich life.
And maybe I got out of banking just in time by the way things have been going.
No kidding. This is a very timely interview. So I was wondering if you had some premonition of what was going on, because there's some real interesting correlations with this new book of yours.
No, I didn't. You know, it's several people have said, you know, it was a very timely thing, but it had absolutely nothing to do with my ability to foresee the future.
Mm-hmm.
I was just going back and looking at those two banks, both Riggs and Bank of New York, as far as where they got caught up in money laundering. But of course, now it's a much broader thing with all of the banks that have been severely damaged by these credit default swaps.
Yeah, it's really, really something. So those, the Riggs and the Bank of New York stories, were those actually stories that inspired this the Money Washers and where you took this new book?
Well, I think money laundering in general was what I had in the back of my mind. And then when I started doing my research, I was reminded of the Bank of New York situation, which I had been familiar with for some time, because it got a lot of press here.
When was that, Alan?
Well, I think it started back probably in the 90s, but it didn't get resolved, or at least the final resolution of all the many, many pieces didn't take place until about 2004 or 2005.
Oh, that recently.
And the same with Riggs, although, you know, Riggs was a slightly different situation, but Bank of New York was a pure money laundering operation that some of their fairly senior managers got caught up in, and it was quite a mess.
You know, at the beginning of your book, you make a very interesting statement, and it's regarding the IMF and the estimates of money laundering to be about $600 billion annually. I mean, that's staggering.
It is staggering, but when you consider what kinds of funds are involved, for example, petrodollars, which are enormous in size, and armament dollars, which are enormous in size, and drug dollars.
Mm-hmm.
You have three huge markets, and of course there are many, many legitimate transactions, if you want to call them that, going on in those markets, but there are also some very illegitimate transactions going on in those markets. And, for example, that's how countries, rogue countries, as they're described by our country here, get their hands on arms and get their hands on drugs and get their hands on oil. So it goes on.
So that's through money laundering. That's so interesting.
Well, it's money laundering and, of course, it's people.
Right.
It's money laundering is the vehicle it is used, but people in powerful places are the ones that have to make it work, because if you just said, well, I'm going to go and launder some money today, unless you had the organization in place or the structure in place, you couldn't do that. And then you probably have to bribe some people along the way to make it work, particularly in the large amounts, but maybe also in the smaller amounts, because we see it in these petty drug operations all the time. You know, they're only dealing in hundreds of thousands of dollars rather than millions and billions.
And, you know, you talk about this figure of $600 billion, and you kind of put that up against, say, this recent financial bailout of $750 billion. I mean, you know, that's such a huge amount of money, but when you look at that, $600 billion, that's annually.
Right. And that might have been annually at that point in time. That probably fluctuates as wildly as the stock market fluctuates. But the $700 billion, of course, is an amount that is considered to be a minimal amount.
Mm-hmm.
If you take the credit default swaps that seem to underlie a lot of the problems, and that's kind of tricky too, but it's leveraging up the problem. What a credit default swap does is leverage the problem, and it ends up being not $750 billion, but maybe $30 or $40 trillion by the time you put the multiplier on it. So the amounts are almost, well, they are mind-boggling, to say the least.
Yes, absolutely. Well, now, you living in New York City, I mean, you are right there. You are in the thick of it. What is the atmosphere like there right now?
Well, New York's an awfully big place, and there's a lot of resilient people here, and there's an awful lot of money here. And so even though some of it is not sloshing around Wall Street the way they would like it to these days, and I think Wall Street is being hard hit by job cuts and some of the mergers going on and some of the bankruptcies of companies like Lehman Brothers and the problems of AIG. And, you know, so all of those things have people kind of looking over their shoulder as they're walking around, wondering if they're going to be next.
Mm-hmm.
So that's going on, and to the extent that these companies are big taxpayers, that affects New York City's ability to do all the things it wants to do and needs to do as a large city. So those things are there, but it's a very powerful place here, and there's always a tremendous amount of enthusiasm for all kinds of things. So it's not as though the whole city is in a big funk.
Good to hear. So you're still okay in your cozy Upper West Side apartment writing?
Well, we are, although we keep our eye on the window.
Yeah, I bet you do.
Watch for the slings and arrows that might be sailing through the air.
Yeah. So over this last year, since we had a chance to talk last, what's been going on in your world?
Well, when I get my head down and I start working on a new novel, and there isn't much that goes on other than that process, because it tends to take a lot of time, for me at least, to gather together all the information and then rework it and try to get it into a story that makes sense to me and hopefully to the readers. So that pretty much occupies all of my time. And then when you throw in a couple of trips to the West Coast, Canada, and the United States, and that kind of thing, it pretty much uses up all the time I have.
Yeah, absolutely. You do a lot of traveling, and I know that the setting, you travel and you use these different places that you've lived or traveled as settings for your books.
Well, I do, but I do it by default. It's not that I say, well, I want to do New Orleans, so I go to New Orleans and write. That's not what I do, although that thought has crossed my mind.
Yeah,
and,
not too bad.
But, no, and same with Washington, D.C., because I've been there many times, but I don't have enough of it in my brain to sit down and start writing stories that make sense to someone who lives there. But all the places I write about, I've been to, and when I'm making a story, when I'm starting to write a story, whether it be in Calgary or New York City or North Dakota or whatever, I simply say, okay, I want part of this story to be there because I think these characters would go there. or will be there, or I just like the setting and I want to create a story in that setting.
Mm-hmm.
But New York's the same. If I'm doing something on New York, for example, in the Praetorian file, which was the one before this one, I had a piece of that that took place on the Staten Island Ferry and involved the Staten Island side of that. So what I did was I hopped on the subway here, and I rode down to the Staten Island Ferry like Paige Harrington would have, and I got off, and I got on the ferry, and I went across to the Staten Island side and recorded all the things I saw and smelled and heard, and then I came back and wrote that chapter.
Oh, interesting. And that really will enhance the writing, and it's a way, I imagine, to really draw the readers in. It's more palpable when you write like that.
Well, I think it is, because when you're on the ferry, you smell the fish in the water.
Mm-hmm.
You see the big tankers going by. You see the Statue of Liberty, and you see how the people react to seeing the Statue of Liberty. And then when you leave Manhattan and you cross to Staten Island, even though the distance is probably, I don't know, 5 miles or less, and it's like you've gone to a different world.
Mm-hmm.
So you're seeing and sensing people doing different things, mostly going home from work, I guess. So yeah, I think it's absolutely critical that one do that.
Mm-hmm. So now The Money Washer, this is book 3 for Paige Harrington, for your Paige Harrington series. Is
yes.
this going to be the final farewell to your heroine, or do you have future plans?
She's definitely in my mind.
Yeah.
she's definitely in my mind, but I haven't quite figured out what kind of a story I want her to be in. I want to be careful that I don't create a cookie-cutter type of character and situation. And that's very easy for me to do, because I would tend to go back into banking again, but I've just done that, and I don't think I want to do that again.
Mm-hmm.
So I've kicked around a couple of ideas in my mind. One involves Washington, D.C., and there was an intern that was murdered there several years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Paige Harrington might like to look into that.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
And then Paige lives in one of the most magnificent, ornate buildings in New York City. And it's been there since probably 1890, and it's huge. It looks like a giant spaceship from Star Wars.
Mm-hmm.
And you see it sitting there, and people are always buying these apartments and remodeling them. And I thought, you know, somewhere in there, there is a skeleton in a closet, a real one.
That's great.
So I thought, you know, something like that could be fun.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, she's such an interesting character. I imagine it would be hard for you to drop her completely.
It would be hard for that reason, yes. And she's very much part of me now.
Mm-hmm.
And she has a lot of fans, so
yeah.
I keep getting a dig from a lot of readers who say, you know, when's your next Paige novel coming out?
Yeah, exactly. Okay, well, why don't you, for our listeners today that aren't really familiar with Paige, and then the first two books in this series, so Barely Dead was where we first met her, and then the second, The Praetorian File, why don't you kind of give us a brief introduction through those two books?
Okay, a brief introduction to Paige.
Yeah, and kind of what happens in those stories. Now, I know that the books in this series don't actually build on each other, but just so we can
kind of have an idea. Okay, well, when I wrote Barely Dead, I created Paige to be my protagonist, and I created her in a town in southern Alberta, a town of about 10,000 people, I guess, because it was a town that I'm very familiar with and occupied by people I'm very familiar with in terms of in generalities. I've never lived in that town, but I know it well.
Mm-hmm.
So I made her a daughter of privilege. Her father is a Superior Court judge. She did all the things that a daughter of privilege in a town that size would get to do or had an opportunity to do, so I let her do all of them. She was a ballet dancer. She was a marksman. She was an Olympic swimmer. She's a skier. And she also is tall and very attractive. And she became a model right out of high school. And then she left modeling after touring Toronto and Montreal and New York and Paris and Italy, Milan and so on. She wanted something more than that, and she knew modeling wouldn't last, so she went to Columbia University here in New York City and took her course in journalism and decided after working for a few newspapers in and around this country, she wanted to be a freelancer so she could see more of the world and write more of what she wanted to write instead of being assigned things to write. So she was, in fact, in Europe writing some stories for a couple of magazines in New York when her father called and said that her best friend in this little town in Alberta where she'd grown up had, the father said he'd committed suicide, but she knew that he hadn't, so she went home to Canada and she wanted to find out what had happened to him. And in the process of doing that, I created this story called Barely Dead, where she became a stripper in Calgary to investigate what had happened not only to her friend who had a connection to this strip bar, but to another girl that had been murdered around the same time who actually worked at this strip bar. So that was Barely Dead. And through that, she also uncovered some corruption in government and local townspeople who were doing some bribing and whatnot to build a fertilizer plant that was going to befoul the air and contaminate the water. Mm-hmm. So that was my story in Barely Dead, and she did find out who, in fact, her friend had been murdered, and she found out who had done that. So that was the story there. Then in the Praetorian Files, she had come back to New York to occupy her apartment where she now lives and was asked by the editor of a magazine here in New York City to meet, I guess you could call her a genius scientist from MIT. And the morning they were supposed to meet, they discovered that she had been murdered. Mm-hmm. And so the Praetorian File was the story of Paige trying to find out who had done this. And it turns out that it was a group of very powerful government leaders, businessmen, and lawyers in New York City who were after her invention, after the genius scientist's invention, which was kind of a thinking robot invention. So, and she got caught up with that on the one side, and they were going to actually kill her, and she escaped along with her, she saved her friend and kind of just in dying moments of the story, and it builds up to quite a high pitch of excitement.
Yeah. So she is she's courageous. She's a very courageous woman.
Well, she is. She doesn't shy away from very much, and because of her background, there's not much that she doesn't feel comfortable doing. And I think that was important that, for example, in the Praetorian File, the fact that she had been an Olympic swimmer helped her there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And in Barely Dead, the fact that she was a dancer, a ballet dancer, enabled her to become a stripper and use a lot of those talents without having to learn how to dance.
Yeah.
In The Money Washers, her ability to defend herself is drawn upon as she goes along on her route to try and find out what happened again to our friend who has disappeared.
And we'll be back with more Inside Scoop Live after these important announcements.
Whether you've already written your manuscript or are contemplating writing one, you will need to create a book proposal. ReaderViews has a coaching service to help you create an enticing book proposal for your work of fiction or nonfiction. In fact, ReaderViews will even submit your book proposal to publishers and agents they have created a relationship with, and then they promise to pursue these submissions. Go to readerviews.com today and click on Services for Authors to find out more information on book proposals and how ReaderViews can help you. Welcome back to Inside Scoop Live. Just to remind you, I'm talking today with Alan McLeod about his new book, The Money Washer. You can find out more about Alan through his website, wammac.web.aplus.net. Yeah, well, tell us, kind of give us a synopsis of what happens in The Money Washers as we go along this.
I start the story off by explaining that there's some very powerful people involved in money laundering, and some have tried to find out who they are and how they work, and they're all dead.
Yeah.
So I thought that was a good place to start, and then I introduced Paige's friend in banking and her connection to Paige, and the two of them decide that, you know, and then there's also a banker that's murdered around the same time who has the same profile as Paige's friend. She's an international banker. She has Russian clients, and they think that perhaps the Russian mafia has something to do with her murder, and perhaps it has something to do with money laundering or drug money or something like that. So Paige is concerned for her friend. Her friend is concerned, but not as concerned as Paige. But they start trying to track down what might have happened, and they find out that, that in fact, there are people that they're starting to talk to that they've been introduced to that are extremely powerful people, and they are, in fact, unbeknownst to Paige and her friend, the ones involved in money laundering.
Mm-hmm.
So these people are helping them out on the one hand, but more to keep an eye on them on the other hand. And so as this escalates, they become increasingly involved in this danger, because the more they find out, the more they're a threat to these extremely powerful people. And these powerful people are connected into the CIA and to all levels of industry. For example, if you say, I don't know how many people remember Oliver North, but and the Iran-Contra affair, but, you know, there are people in high places that don't hesitate to abuse the power that they have. And so that's what they were running up against. And so I created a story around this abuse of power and how they were being threatened by it, and how they had to move rather adroitly to keep out of the clutches of this group of people.
And this group of people is undoubtedly the most dangerous group that she's had to deal with so far.
Probably, but not much more so than in the Praetorian file.
Mm.
The Praetorian group was based on the old Italian, the old Italian guards,
mm-hmm.
The Praetorians, and back in the time of Caesar. And so I created kind of a group of powerful people like the Italian guards became. And so that was a very dangerous group that she had to deal with there also.
So with you having had experience in the banking world, obviously we've already mentioned that, but, you know, with your own artistic license to go anywhere in this book, is it pure fiction, or is there anything from your past that you witnessed that you're bringing into this story?
It's other than Reeves and the Bank of New York.
Mm-hmm.
Money Washers and the others are pure fiction.
Mm-hmm.
And they're just stories that I've manufactured out of my mind, but every one of them, based on what I've seen and what I read and what I know, could happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's, I think when one lives around big money and powerful people and in a big city, there isn't much that ends up being surprising after a while.
I guess not. You know, and that's an interesting driving force for you in your books, the whole idea of corruption and greed. And a lot of times government corruption pops into your books. Where does this actually come from that you have wanted to make it consistent themes through all of your books?
Well, I think just being a student of what goes on in government and industry and in corporations, I would like to think that my disdain for corruption in government and industry is equal.
Mm.
There are ample cases of corporate corruption and ample cases of government corruption at all levels. Mm-hmm. And so, therefore, I just think that it makes for interesting fodder
mm-hmm.
for any story.
Oh, absolutely. Do you think with what's happening now and the exposing of so much corruption that has been going on, do you think that we're going to see a domino effect of corruption being exposed through industry, through government, through banking for years to come?
I hope so.
Yeah, me too.
You know, it's just staggering to see what these people are draining from the system.
Mm-hmm.
And they're draining it from the system at your cost and at my cost and everybody else's, you know. And as all these people you see interviewed from time to time on CNN and other news channel, you know, they're losing their house, they're losing their car, and they're losing their job. They don't have health care. You know, as they rightly say, where's my bailout, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You know, you just have to say, yeah, where is their bailout?
Mm-hmm.
And so it makes me mad, and it makes a lot of people mad, and I just happen to write about it.
You have a great outlet for that.
Yeah, right.
And I understand that you also collect press clippings of these kinds of stories. And
I do.
Yeah, interesting. So what kind of clippings have you been collecting lately? Obviously, what's going on there, you know, in New York and with the stock market. Is that pretty much predominantly what you're collecting?
Some of that, but that's pretty second nature to me.
Mm-hmm.
So I can pretty much, I mean, that's always in my mind, and if I want to research that, I can just go online and research it.
Mm-hmm.
But what I take clippings of, and I keep them in an electronic file. I don't physically cut out the newspaper, but I'll find a newspaper article that I'm interested in, then I'll go online and find it, and I'll capture it and store that in one of my electronic files, so that I have a whole encyclopedia almost of press clippings under various headings.
Mm.
And the ones that I'm attracted to are the ones that I can look at and say, there's almost a whole story right in this press clipping. You know, there is betrayal, there is murder, there is theft, or at least I can manufacture those things out of what the story is saying. Mm-hmm. For example, there was a woman at one time not too long ago who murdered her husband in Hong Kong, and he was a banker. And she was having an affair here in the States. And then not long after that, the murdered banker in Hong Kong's brother in Connecticut was murdered in a totally unrelated deal, or at least it seemed like it was totally unrelated. And so far, nobody's made the connection, but under very suspicious circumstances. He was found in the basement of his house, and his wife had left him, and, you know, just
mm-hmm.
those
mm-hmm.
kinds of things, and families getting involved in companies that have been left to them by their father or grandfather or whatever who started this. And it's now a marvelous company, but now the children are fighting over what's left.
Mm-hmm.
So those are always interesting kinds of things. That's what I tend to collect.
Mm-hmm. You must have to find some balance with some positive things, too, because you could probably get very jaded just immersing yourself in all of that, thinking, you know, what's going on with society these days.
Well, I think the balance is a Paige Harrington.
Is your writing, yeah.
Is the fact that I can create the positive through her or through whatever protagonist I decide to use. I think if I were going to write one of these purely from the antagonist side, where everything was dark and they were doomed to end up being killed in the worst way, I don't think I would have much fun doing that.
Yeah.
It would be too depressing.
Yeah, right. Good point. Well, what are you working on now, Alan?
I'm trying to figure out what I'm going to be working on.
Mm-hmm.
I have a book that's ready to go in the sense that it's all down on paper. I'm not sure all the words that I want and the order I want is there, but this is one that I am definitely going to publish, although it's not a Paige Harrington, and I guess that's why I've been holding off a bit, but I think I'll probably do it next.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, probably start working up another Paige Harrington. I do have another one that I've started with a male protagonist detective in New York City who is not a police detective, but a private eye who works out of a kind of a musty, dusty office down in Greenwich Village, and that might go somewhere. I've written a few chapters, and I've run by a few people, and they seem to like it as much as I do, so that might have some possibilities.
Mm-hmm. So you find that you can have a few projects going like that and be able to keep up with them instead of just focusing on one?
If one is largely completed, yes.
Yeah.
But I could never, ever have two going along at exactly the same rate of speed from beginning to end. I think that would probably just drive me totally insane.
Yeah, that would be a lot of juggling.
It's hard enough. I find it extremely difficult, particularly if, as I did in this last one, where I write it from several points of view, as opposed to just from mostly Paige's point of view.
Mm-hmm.
It's very difficult to keep the timeline straight because, you know, you've got to make sure that what someone is doing isn't happening before it could happen. You know, it's got to take place in the order of events. Like, I can't start writing a chapter and talk about this conversation if we haven't had it yet.
Right.
So it involves a lot of spreadsheets.
And I understand you go through a very intensive editing process as well.
Well, I do.
Mm-hmm.
First myself, I write and rewrite and rewrite and rewrite, and I drive myself crazy. And about everybody else around me that's within hearing distance. And then I have some close friends who are pretty good at it, in fact, excellent at it.
Mm-hmm.
And they go through it, and then they drive me crazy.
Yeah.
Go through that again. And then what I do after that process is finished is that I seek out volunteers and people I don't know, and I always find 7 or 8 or 10 or 12 volunteers, and I send them 100 pages.
Mm-hmm.
And they go through that 100 pages. It's generally not consecutive, but because I don't want them to get focused on the story. I want them to focus on the words.
Mm-hmm.
And so then that comes back, and that's pretty much the last.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But it's not fun.
It's quite a process. It really is. Well, do you have any time in all of that to do any reading yourself, or are you more of a writer?
Well, I'm almost embarrassed to say this, but first of all, I want to preface this by saying I love books.
Mm-hmm.
I love the covers of books. I love trying to figure out when I look at a cover what the story is.
Mm-hmm.
And then, having said that, I listen to my books.
Oh.
I download them from one of the places, and I put them on my iPod. And so I listen to books all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm always reading two or three at the same time. But what I do is I take them with me when I'm on the subway or on the bus or in a cab, and I read 3 or 4 pages here and so on. So I always have several books on the go, but I'm all every day I listen faithfully for half an hour because I'm a walker.
Mm-hmm.
And when I go out for my power walk every morning, I have my iPod plugged in and I'm listening to something or other.
It's amazing where technology has taken us today.
I know, and it's kind of upsetting as a self-published author that so many people are now listening to books, because it's almost impossible for a self-published author to create an audiobook.
Yeah,
it's too expensive.
It's very expensive.
I did one of mine myself, and I don't know that I'm ever going to let it hit the light of day.
mm-hmm. You know, I think that at some point it will have to come sort of full circle, you know, and we'll get back to the whole idea of sitting with a book in hand, because there's something very special about that, you know.
No question, but I fear that the younger generation is being weaned off of books.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what they see is video.
Yeah.
And YouTube is an enormous example of that.
Mm-hmm.
And so, therefore, what they want to see are video-type books. So the closest we can get right now to that is audiobooks. But I can foresee the day when there will probably be books on YouTube where some form of video and audio will marry up, and there you go.
Yeah, interesting times. Well, I know that one of the new ways of getting known and getting out there is blogging, and you have a blog yourself, and you've got quite a few stories put up there.
I have a short story blog, and that gets fairly good readership. I also used to have a political blog, but I found it too hard to contribute the right amount of time when I was involved in writing a novel, so I had to drop that, but I'll probably pick it up again at some point.
I imagine you have to be on that day-to-day because things change so much in that realm.
Well, I published it once a week, and it was a collection of headlines with the name of that blog was Extra Rye with a twist, so what I did was I plucked the headlines out of the week's papers, and then I'd comment on them. I'd maybe pick 12 that I thought were outrageous. And I'd put them down, and I'd write, you know, a paragraph or two. But the fun of it was trying to make my own headline so that it caught people's attention. And it generally had to do with corruption in government or in industry.
Along the same lines. How interesting. Well, let's mention your website again here, Alan. Our time is kind of coming to an end, and I want to make sure that we get that in. So what's your website?
Well, you want the actual address of it?
Yeah, you have a few, just so our listeners today can go to it and find out more about you, and your books can be purchased there as well.
Okay. My Lulu website is where they can buy my books, and that's at HTTP in the usual format, /stores.lulu.com/WAMMAC. And my actual website is on, I think the best way to do all this, you know, so that people don't have to write down a bunch of stuff, is just Google my name.
Google your name. Okay.
Yeah, if you just Google Alan McLeod, I think the first thing they're going to see is my website.
Okay.
And then they might see some Amazon stuff. And, of course, all my books are on Amazon, too.
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess if they Google Alan McLeod and then maybe the Money Washers, that will pop up for sure, right there.
Right. Just Googling Alan McLeod will take them to my website. And there on my website, I have all of my books listed. And links to all of my blogs. So they'll find more of me than they probably want to find.
That's great. Well, it's been wonderful talking with you again and finding out what you've been up to and hearing about the Money Washers. And it just really sounds like a great third novel in this series.
Just when you said that, I said, I probably should have written one called The Money Watchers.
Yeah, right. Well, there you go. There's another idea.
Right.
Well, thank you so much, Alan. Was there any final thoughts you wanted to share with listeners today?
I think you've pretty well exhausted my brain power.
Okay. Well, I apologize for that.
No, not at all. It doesn't take much, but you did it well.
Oh, good, good. Well, it's been a pleasure talking with you again, and I know we will do it sometime in the future, so you just take care of yourself until then.
Fine. Thank you very much.
Best to you. Okay, listeners, once again, that's been Alan McLeod, and he has just released his fourth book, which is the third in his Paige Harrington mystery series titled The Money Washers. So check it out, and as mentioned, the best way to find out more about Alan is just to Google Alan McLeod. Also, if you want specifics, wammac.web.aplus.net, and that will take you directly there. So I want to thank you again for tuning in to Inside Scoop Live. I'm Juanita Watson, and until next time.